Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this first hour. Boy oh boy, it was a busy week full of calls that I had, almost 10, sometimes 12 calls a day throughout the week. I had a lot of daily editorials and a lot of company introductions and follow-up interviews, following up on news. Please, everybody, keep those emails coming to me. I know that the sector, especially for precious metals, has been relatively slow, but there's still some companies out there with some good news, and that news does move some of the stocks. So, as I said, keep those emails coming. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a bit more broadly on the financial markets and try to look past all this volatility that undoubtedly will continue into the election, and who knows how long the actual election results are going to take. But fact of the matter is, we need to understand some of the bigger term trends that are at play here. I'm happy to say that I'm kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor. He is the president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, and also for the retail trader, writes in the No Trader, and has also started up a new piece called 7-Eleven, where he picks no more than 7 of the 11 total spider ETFs. Rick, let's start off with the U.S. equity markets. Broad question for you being, is it surprising to you that we have U.S. markets, something like the S&P that just a week and a half ago was testing out nearly at all-time highs, a broad melt-up heading into an election and a nasty election? This isn't typical for what we see during the couple weeks and even couple months heading into an election. What's going on here?
Hey, Corey. Well, I think it's a combination of a few things at play here. Of course, the Fed has been very accommodative, continues to be, and lets it be very widely known that they will be in the future very supportive of the markets. And that's not something that is normally the case going into an election, especially a presidential election. The country hasn't typically come back from, well, certainly has never had a virus to deal with like we have going into this election. So there certainly have been things at play here that are atypical compared to just your average presidential election. So you have an accommodative Fed. And the other thing that I think is keeping the market somewhat well bid, we sold off in September and it's come back a bit. And the S&P is, 100 points, give or take, 125 points from its all-time high. Why is the S&P trading at 3460? And what my take is, because Biden has basically held a double-digit lead in the polls, I think there's just more and more feeling that you could end up getting this what's been called this blue wave, where the Democrats control the White House and now possibly end up winning enough Senate seats to take control of the Senate and hold on to their majority in the House such that they control all three houses of Congress and essentially be able to pass a stimulus package much more quickly than what we see in day in, day out headlines going back and forth. In the last week, it's been Pelosi and Mnuchin talking, but nothing gets resolved. It just doesn't get done. And, getting if the Democrats can pull off a sweep like that, then I think it's fairly good for the markets. Months ago, and even last night on the presidential debates, where President Trump was saying that if Joe Biden gets into the White House, the stock market's going to crash. I don't think the stock market's going to crash. Could it come off, 5%? Sure. Could it come off more than that? It could even come off 10%, but coming off 10% is not the end of the world with it being where it is now. It'd still be kind of north of 3,000. And, it's not the worst thing. So I think the market generally holds up now because the factors at play, including an earnings season that we're still young into this third quarter earnings season, but so far the bulk of companies have beaten estimates, so you're having a decent earnings season. Once again, analysts are too conservative in their research reports on where companies are going to report, and I think the market generally is okay. And again, if it falls back, I've had for, 6 months, my preferred buy zone, and your listeners, might care about this because we got down to the top end of it on the September sell-off. I'm basically a buyer from just north of 3,200 down to about 3,050. That is my preferred buying zone that I have written out for months. So I'd love to see the market pull back. Give me a 10% pullback. Nothing I'd like right now more than that. I'd find it a lot easier buying stocks with the S&P at 3,100 than I do at 3,400. So I'd be very happy to have a pullback, and it's not going to spook me out. I've told people have resting bids. In that area, kind of scale down your bids and start at, I'd say, 3210, which is basically the September low. And whether you want to do every 25 S&P points or however you want to play it, scale down to like 3050. And I think that more or less will contain the decline. And if it goes a little past that, that's fine. I don't see the market going hugely beneath that. And therefore, I'm comfortable if that were to occur.
Okay. Now, Rick, is this comfort with a pullback also correlated with how high sentiment numbers have been? You and I haven't talked about this before, but I know that you work a lot with behavioral finance. And when we do see sentiment levels reaching, upper levels, extremes almost, we're not quite there yet. It means that sentiment's a bit too buoyant and pullbacks are needed. How do you view the current sentiment levels tied in with your call or your hope for, let's say, a 10% fall?
Often sentiment polls are not polling professionals, but polling individual investors or newsletter writers. And so they haven't gotten enough extreme. But yeah, they're certainly in the bullish category. And when they get very bullish, that's often when I start looking about making cases for why I might want to be bearish. Case in point, when the March sell-off occurred this year on March 23rd, the day that made the low, the poll I look at most had only 3% bulls for S&P futures, and that was one of the reasons why I turned bullish March 23rd. We haven't gotten anything close to that on the flip side, so you're not anything near upper 90s at all. For those figures. And a lot of people you talk to don't trust this market. So even though the market itself has held up, the sentiment figures haven't gotten overly concerning by being too bullish. And I think, there's a lot of people still waiting for this market to pull back. And I'm not talking about taking out March lows. There's no reason to think that that's going to happen or would happen, especially given the fact that the Fed has said they will support the markets as they need to. So I think it's pretty safe to say there's nothing that's going to happen unless we go into a full-on depression that would have us revisit 2020 lows. So if you got the chance to buy, the S&P 3100 or 3000 or anything near there, I think you do it. It's not quite mid-range of what we've seen this year. But I think that it makes sense to do that, and you still have an accommodative Fed. And at that point, with the market coming off, if that were to happen, you'd probably get sentiment right down much more towards, 50% bulls, 50% bears. And with a Fed that's really backstopping this the market from falling considerably, I think that would, that's my sweet spot.
Rick, let's look into some of the sectors within the market too, because there has been this broad rotation. We're not seeing just a handful of high-flying tech stocks lead these markets higher. The rotation has brought in better breadth and, well, this still better sentiment levels in general. When it comes to your 7-Eleven report, what are some of the sectors that you think have a sustainable bull market, a longer-term run ahead of them?
Okay, well, you know, most people are going to start off by thinking about how is technology going to play? It's the largest piece of the S&P, and it's somewhere around, I don't know, I put it at 27%, give or take, of the total S&P. So nothing comes close to it as far as the proportion of the S&P. So technology should always be on people's minds. And the question is there still room for the growthier part of the market, especially in the technology sector, to keep performing the way it has? I'm getting some signs that it is starting to tire. I think unless you are a pure kind of scalper trader, you've got to always have exposure in XLK or something that represents the technology sector. And then it's just a question of, do you want to be overweight the whatever benchmark you're using to represent technology, or equal weight, or if you're really, you know, kind of speculating that tech has seen the best it's going to see for a while, then you go slightly underweight. I wouldn't go heavily underweight. I still think it is the future. So tech is something I'm always going to want to have exposure in, and it's a matter of, I've been overweight tech for a while now. We are overweight tech in the 7-Eleven report. I will probably cut it back a little bit on the November 1st issue, and that's, you know, going into elections. I publish this either on the 31st. I try to get it in the hands of the clients on the 31st of each month, or the 30th, whatever the case may be, or certainly early in the day on the 1st. And, you know, so I've got to make a decision before the election results are, people come out for election day and the results are known, what to do. But I think that I would probably take my overweight down and get closer to benchmark weight. I don't think I'm ready yet to make any material move as far as it being a significant underweight. And the other area that I like going forward, and we put into the one of the seven spider ETFs last month, the only one I added that hadn't been there, so in the prior month I only had six on, is industrials, XLI. And I think that kind of regardless if Trump holds on and wins or Biden gets in there, that infrastructure in this country is something that's going to be needed to be invested in at the government level and at the local and state level. And so I kind of like industrials now too. And I've, you know, I've pushed them up to a mild overweight. So we have XLI on. A little bit more than its benchmark total. It's a very small group, but like materials, which I think is only about 3% of the S&P, the last couple months I've been running at about 6%, so I have been overweight them. I may take that back a little bit too. And consumer discretionary has done decently. You know, so far the places to truly have been avoiding are financials, energy, and then the interest rate sensitive ones, so you're talking about real estate and utilities. So those are your really bad underperformers this year. And financials certainly are trying to get a bid. You know, the problem is the market is so long financials that even with interest rates having moved up in the last several weeks and kind of a breakout above 75 basis points in yield terms in the U.S. 10-year, you haven't really seen a significant move up in financials. And part of that is, I think, the market is, and has been for a long time, waiting for rates to go up, and financials have been bid for by portfolio managers. So unless they really want to commit a lot more money to that sector, it's kind of... The names are cheap, but they're having trouble getting sustainable bids across the banks and other pieces of the financial sector, simply because I think in general, portfolio managers are fairly long that anyway. But, you know, we monitor this, and just avoiding even energy has been, you know, so far a home run. So we have not been in energy. I don't think we've been in staples, utilities, or REITs. So, you know, we've been able to outperform since we started the 7-Eleven monthly report on August 1st by being able to stay out of the bad sectors. And you will, you know, just think about it from simple mathematics. If you avoid the underperforming sectors, you will outperform the S&P. And, you know, that's our goal. And that's why people subscribe to my newsletter, is to know when to shift into underperformers that will either start outperforming or simply underperform by a lot less, or tail off on, you know, the overweights, and you cut those down. And so I'm constantly changing things there. It's like an active managed fund, but you're limited to no more than the 11 sectors, and we won't have you in more than 7 at any one time.
Yeah. Hey, very simple, very straightforward there, Rick. I always find it interesting to see which ones you're adding, which ones you're avoiding. Your comments on the banking sector, though, ties in perfectly with the next topic being the bond market. We're seeing yields, especially on the long end, creep higher. Even the 10-year was closing in on its 200-day moving average. The 10-year hasn't traded above that 200-day moving average since mid-2008. The 30-year, the yield there is creeping to levels that we haven't seen since May of last year, 2019. What's this general increase in the long end of yield, of the yield curve? What's this telling you about what investors are expecting?
Well, what it says to me is that the economy is not as bad as most people think, because you wouldn't see the yield curve widen out if there was real concern and sustained concern. Now, today, you know, we finally hit the 200-day for the first time, as you say, in a long time. And that came in, I think, at 85 basis points. So it's, you know, we're finally hitting that. It's tailed off. So, you know, going to close out the week, it looks like 84 basis points is what it's going to be. But that's up decently this week, because last Friday, I think, was 74 basis points. So we gained 10 basis points this week. And then on a percentage basis, from 74 to 84 is huge. For 1 week, and I think you're finally starting to see people wake up to the fact that U.S. interest rates are not going down to 0% the way so many people had thought, that you'd have zero or even negative rates here on the 10-year. And what I've told clients is, as long as yields are above 64 basis points, so, you know, 0.64%, then this breakout is still valid. And only if we got back underneath 64 basis points would it then call into question, you know, the breakout in the yield. So I targeted on a move above 74 basis points that we would get to 93 to 94 as a target. You know, we've been moving up, and no surprise that because we hit the 200-day today, that you're seeing some buyers show up in the bond market, or on a yield chart basis, you know, sellers against the 200-day move average in rate terms. But I think there's still a decent chance that we get our target at 94 and 93 to 94, and it may actually move higher than that. So to me, it all, as long as we're above 64 basis points, I'm going to play that this is a breakout.
Does this rising long end play into any changes that the Fed might have in terms of policy, in terms of maybe the bond market forcing the Fed's hands? Or do you carry this over to any sort of inflation or deflation narrative?
I think it's more of a, if I had to choose one or the other, I would choose it more as an inflation narrative. And one of the things I track on the front page of the supposedly irrelevant factors institutional report that I write Sunday nights, we kind of monitor 10 markets and how institutions are positioned within the markets and where they lay out kind of technically against reference points, to help get a sense of, is the professional investment community banking on inflationary pressures or not. And it's been very, very neutral for quite some time. And a week or two ago was the first time we got any whiff of inflationary pressures. And I said, you know, we're starting to see it, but it's too early to call a trend that it's going to stay sustained that way. But at least we, for the first time in months, we saw some indication that down the road, there's some mild inflationary concerns. But again, it's too early for me to even call that a trend or make a declarative statement that the market is concerned about this yet. It's just the beginning signs of it. And I think the, you know, the yield curve, the I look at the 30s, meaning the U.S. 30-year yields minus the U.S. 5-year yields. That to me is, a lot of people look at 10s to 2s, and I do as a trading vehicle, but to get a better view of what the marketplace and the people who really care about the longer end of the curve, which typically pension funds, the fact that they have widened that out and broke above 120 basis points, which is where a significant downtrend line was. We got to 124. It pulled back to 120 last week. I'm not sure where we go out this week, but that should have moved back up again. And I think that's indicative also of a sense that down the road, there is some initial positioning towards an inflationary future.
Okay. Well, that is something it sounds like might take a little while, but I know central banks have been trying to get that inflation on track for a while. It's going to be very interesting, at least to me, to see where or what spurs that inflation, because boy, oh boy, central banks have tried everything and they have not been able to get that inflation that they want, at least in
not at
the
all
way they measure it. Let's also talk about FX and commodities. The U.S. dollar still really struggling. It's actually closing in on a couple breakdown levels. As we wrap up this week, the dollar's in the 92 region. You carry that over to some of the commodities. Base metals have been doing better over the last few weeks to a month, but the precious metals, they've been stuck. Gold still right around 1900. Can't seem to get any moves up or down that are sustainable. How are you balancing out the weakness in the dollar and how that carries over to certain commodities?
So I still think that the dollar, we called the short-term bottom over the summer, and we got it perfectly when the dollar index got tucked just beneath 92. We called that a trading low. And we got to almost 95, and it's pulled back down. And right now, I think to close out the week, we're about 92.72. We're still just a smidgen above that long-term uptrend line that goes all the way back to 2011 that helped determine that low we saw over the summer. So we're pressing against it again. If we get any significant break under, I guess, about 91.80 or so, I think 87.5 comes into play in 2021. And if that's the case, and the dollar really does start getting a more meaningful breakdown, because remember, we got as high as 102 and change in March this year when the dollar rallied, when the world was falling apart, when COVID hit and the stock market sold off, the S&P got down to, what was it, 2200, the dollar was up over 102, and it's been fading ever since. So it's been going in the exact opposite direction that the stock market's been going. So as stocks went up, the dollar's been down. And if we take out the lows of 2020, then you potentially open the door for this move to 87.5-ish as an initial downside target from this from that breakdown. And that is going to help certainly the precious metals, which are priced in dollars. It's also going to help the emerging market type of investments. So I think, you know, a weak dollar is good for, take something like EEM, the ETF that's, you know, one of the most popular ETF for the emerging markets. Brazil, EWZ, any type of emerging market will benefit from a weaker dollar. And those are potential investments for people to look at too as the US dollar goes down. And if it goes down significantly, we get this break to new lows, then I think metals will move higher. And at some point, gold may even take out the high that it made this year, which is also its all-time high. Silver has been, a much worse performer than gold. It's not even near its all-time highs of $50 an ounce. It's been hanging out in the mid-20s. So silver potentially could have room to go, but gold is the psychological metal of choice as a hedge against inflation, as a hedge against anything going wrong in the world. It's always gold. So silver's obviously much cheaper. It's an industrial metal, not nearly as industrial as it used to be when it was used for film. And of course, X-rays still need silver, but now that everybody uses and has for 20 years, cameras and camera phones and those that are digital and don't use film, you have far less. You took away a lot of the industrial demand that silver was. But I play the silver market frequently. We've got clients long silver on the 7-year breakout. In the no trader individual investor newsletter I do, we got long at about 16.5, and we still have having that trade on. So that's been a huge winner, and I do think it's finally time for metals to still be a significant recipient of investment dollars over time. But over the summer, I did call and say that I think the high in gold was made for the balance of the year, and that may very well still be the case. So I'm inclined to lean towards silver as a trading vehicle. Just for those of you listening who are not familiar, silver is going to be a much more volatile market than will gold. So, if gold's up 1% on a day, it may be that silver's up 2.5%. Just, it's gold on steroids. So it's going to sell off more and it's going to be bid up more typically. So depending upon if you like that type of price action, you lean towards silver. If you want something a little more conservative, then you'd play gold.
All right. Hey, Rick, we're going to wrap it up there. It's always great spending these extended segments with you. We cover a lot in terms of different markets and I think really what matters. And so far, following along with you, man, you're trading and you are on top of these markets. And I really appreciate you sharing your insights with our audience. Rick, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Thanks again for taking some time. And we'll chat again after the election, hopefully with some more clarity.
Yes. Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure too.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.